This is Focus 580, our morning talk program here on AM 580. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for our program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Henry Frain, is at the controls this morning. On Monday, a ceasefire went into effect, ending a month of fighting between the forces of Israel and Hezbollah. Many civilians have died, and much of Lebanon's infrastructure has been destroyed in this fighting. Just how this war will change the politics of the region and how long this peace may last is anyone's guess. This morning, in this hour of the show, we'll be getting some personal reflections on what this means as we talk with Dr. Martin Akkad. He is the academic dean at the Arab Baptist Theological Seminary in Beirut. You may recall he was here on the program back in March when he was visiting in Champaign-Urbana, talking about a subject that has been a subject of his academic interest, that is interactions between Christians and Muslims. He's currently writing a book on Christian-Muslim dialogue. That was the subject of his doctoral dissertation. He was born in Lebanon. He defended his dissertation on September 11th, 2001, the day of the terrorist attacks in New York. A few days later, he went back to Lebanon and he took up his job at the Arab Baptist Theological Seminary, where he also founded and directs their program, their Institute of Middle East Studies. He got his PhD at Oxford University. This summer, he has been visiting here in the United States, teaching at the Fuller Theological Seminary in Pasadena, California, so has been unable to go back, and we'll find out when he thinks that he can possibly go back as we talk with Dr. Akkad. Just another note about the seminary: the Arab Baptist Theological Seminary was established in 1960. And since its creation, it has graduated almost 200 students from various places around the Middle East: Algeria, Egypt, India, Iraq, Jordan, Lebanon, Morocco, Palestine, Sudan, and Syria. Instruction there is given in Arabic, and is put into the context of the particular needs of the Arab world. He is joining us this morning by telephone. And as we talk, of course, as always, comments from people who are listening are welcome. You want to join the conversation, you certainly may. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers. Dr. Akkad, hello.
Hello.
How are you?
Good. And how about you, Dave?
I'm good. Thanks very much. What is your status now? You've been here now in the United States at Fuller. At what point were you expecting to go home, and when do you think you'll be able to go home?
I got to Pasadena on the 3rd of July, and I was teaching until the 14th and planning to fly back to Beirut on the 16th. And as you know, the conflict began on the 12th, so mm-hmm. I got stuck in Pasadena. I stayed on for a couple of weeks there, and right now I'm just at the end of a two-week stay in Montreal. Mm. So I'm speaking to you from Montreal, where I'm working on my book. I was planning to return at the end of the month now via Syria, but it seems like our airport is beginning again to function. So I'm hoping that perhaps by the end of August or very early September, I can fly back directly to Beirut airport.
Mm-hmm. I think, if I remember this right, the story, it was reported today that the first flight has gone in since this happened back in the middle of July.
A flight from Jordan, So it seems that things are functioning. It needs a political decision, basically. The repairs can be achieved in 48 hours or so.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things that I guess struck me in reading the coverage, and particularly reading about what people are saying since the ceasefire, is the fact that so many people, even people who have lost their homes, think that somehow they won. Everyone seems to be in this conflict claiming victory, although I'm not sure what anybody thinks that they have won. It just makes it one of the many things that for people who, like us, watching it at this distance, find very difficult to understand. I guess I just as a very general sort of question, I want to ask you, what do you make of all of this, particularly that people who would have lost everything at the same time would have been flashing the V for victory and saying, well, but we won?
Yeah, well, politicians need victories in order to in order to make their political victories. So on both sides, and Hezbollah and Israel have been claiming that they won. I think the people on both sides realized that they were the main losers. At the same time, I think the people of Lebanon have shown an ability to resist. I mean, looking at it, we've become practically professional survivors with all that the civil war that we lived also in Lebanon for 16 years. Basically, we know that the only way to survive and move on with our lives is to immediately get back to reconstruction. I think that from a human perspective, it's been disastrous. But the strength of will and willingness to go on of the Lebanese population is, I think, that is the victorious party in all of that. Victory of the will.
You have family that was that you were here. You have family that were there. Do you know what has happened to your home and to the seminary?
Well, most of my family live in Lebanon. My wife had to relocate herself in Cyprus because her work requires of her a lot of travel, and she couldn't travel from Beirut. My family lives in a little bit outside of Beirut, and in a more Christian area. So these areas have not been targeted by Israeli bombing, even though there is an electric power plant in the area. They have very, I mean, the whole bombing was very real. They weren't able to sleep at night because even though you're, 15 kilometers away from Beirut, you're up a little bit in the mountain and you're overlooking the city, and the smog and smoke of all the bombing has just been covering the sky of Beirut for weeks after weeks. The seminary is in also the same area, but what has happened is that hundreds of refugees from the south have taken refuge both at our seminary and at our sister institution, the Beirut Baptist School. We had 800 refugees there throughout this time of conflict. So what has happened in this conflict is that you have hundreds of thousands of Shiite Muslim refugees that have found refuge in primarily Christian areas that were safer during this conflict. And the result has been a coming together of the population and really standing together through this difficult period, regardless of religious affiliation or political affiliation. Hmm.
I think that what makes it difficult for people who don't follow Lebanese politics, or maybe who follow them just a little bit, it makes it difficult to understand what has happened. Going back is when you go back to just last year, when it seemed that there was real progress being made in Lebanon and in Lebanese politics. This was just after the time when there was a real popular movement that rose up against the presence of Syria and Syrian troops following up on the assassination of the former prime minister, Rafik Hariri, in which Syria was implicated. The Lebanese people were very angry. A lot of them were very angry about this. And they said, look, we think that the Syrians should leave. The Syrians, in fact, did. And I think that there was this sense that there was a popular kind of movement growing in Lebanon for a more progressive kind of politics and a more positive kind of future. And then that wasn't all that long ago. And now we have this. It leaves you wondering, well, what exactly happened? What happened between then and now within Lebanese politics that got us to this point?
Well, it's from a Lebanese perspective, from my view as a Lebanese and most Lebanese, there isn't much that has changed, to tell you the truth. The Lebanese population has always been very, very divided on issues. all the way back from the time of the Civil War in 1975 till 1991. And because the population is such a mix of different religious and cultural backgrounds, so a situation like what happened, you know, is there isn't much change. Where for the outside world looking, they're thinking Lebanon was going through an amazing rise in democracy last year. In reality, Lebanon has always had this democratic atmosphere, and in some ways it has played against us because different groups in Lebanon that acquire a louder voice at different times, depending on the political climate, can take the boat in the direction that they want. So right now you have a situation where the Christians and the Sunnis of Lebanon have a common anti-Syrian discourse, whereas the Shiites of Lebanon have a primarily pro-Syrian, much more militant discourse, and that are represented by Hezbollah. So the population is very divided. Last year, after the assassination of Prime Minister Hariri, whereas the anti-Syrian group gathered over 1 million people in the street in demonstration, the Shiite pro-Hezbollah, pro-Syrian group put together, you know, roughly somewhere around 400,000 in the streets. So it's still a significant group and reflects this diversity in political positions. Unfortunately, Lebanon is always part of a larger storm, which is a Middle Eastern storm. And we cannot see our little country find its own peace outside of a regional solution. So, I mean, even right now, the ceasefire is very, as a Lebanese, knowing the Lebanese atmosphere, it cannot be a ceasefire that will last unless some radical regional developments take place, notably with the situation in Palestine, the refugee problem, and all of that. And it's a regional conflict. We cannot escape it as a small nation like Lebanon.
Mm-hmm. That it does seem to be the case that there are many people who look at the ceasefire, or at least some of the comments of people that you have, one has heard on both sides of this divide, saying that they think that this is just a temporary peace, that both sides are using it to consolidate their positions. On the comments you hear from people in Israel, and say that, well, we think that we're going to be back, and certainly Hezbollah is not going anywhere. It seems that part of the agenda here, as far as they were concerned, was to consolidate their power position within Lebanon, and perhaps it has less to do with Israel than it has to do with Lebanon. So, you know, as you say, one wonders just how long this peace is going to be and whether indeed it is temporary.
Well, if anyone is serious about making it long-term, then they really need to aggressively begin to tackle the broader issues of the Middle East. There's no way that, it's meaningless to talk about the disarmament of Hezbollah, meaningless to talk about a security zone, a sort of buffer zone that will be occupied by 15,000 Lebanese soldiers and 15,000 UN peacekeepers or peace enforcement force, as has also been called. It's totally meaningless outside a regional solution. So our only hope from a political perspective is that some real tackling of the broader political problems will begin to be addressed. But and I hope that countries, governments of U.S., U.K., and the U.N. and the rest of the international community will realize that and will address themselves to it.
Perhaps I should introduce again the guest for this hour. We're speaking with Dr. Martin Akkad. He is the academic dean at the Arab Baptist Theological Seminary in Beirut. He was with us visiting when he was in Champaign-Urbana back in March, and we talked about something that has been an interest of his as an academic and also personally for a long time, that is relations between Christians and Muslims. He did his doctoral dissertation on that history. He's working on a book on Christian-Muslim dialogue. He has been the academic dean there at the seminary since the fall of 2001. He also founded and directs the Institute of Middle East Studies there at the Arab Baptist Theological Seminary. Earlier this summer, he was in the United States for a brief time teaching at the Fuller Theological Seminary in Pasadena, California, and was due to go back just at the time that the fighting started. So then he went on to spend some time in Montreal, and so that is where he is there now, and he is hoping soon to be able to go back home, back to Lebanon. Questions here are certainly welcome, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. I guess that we would expect that Lebanese Shiites, particularly people in the south, even people who lost a lot, will, at least for the moment, continue to be supportive of Hezbollah. But one wonders whether here in the future at some point people will start to change their mind, will consider what has been lost, and that maybe more people will come around to the idea that that this wasn't good for Lebanon, and people will perhaps direct some of their anger, at least rhetorically, to Hezbollah.
Well, I think one of the key things to understand this latest conflict is to understand who Hezbollah is. They're often portrayed as a small militant group somehow moved from the outside of Lebanon and like an external group to the Lebanese population. And it's I think it is that that understanding that led Israel to be able to say we're going to go in and get rid of Hezbollah, and then realize that they were dealing with a force very different, very different from what they expected. The reality is that Hezbollah, even if they don't have a very large military, if you want, a military assault power, but on the other hand, you have the Lebanese Shiite population today represents about 35% of our population, 35 to 40%. Probably about 70 or 80% of that population are supporters of Hezbollah, and supporters very often, very actively, in the sense that every man in every home that's able to carry a gun carries it for Hezbollah. So you have entire villages in the south of Lebanon and the Beirut suburbs that represent that force. So it doesn't even make sense to ask whether this population is going to rise up against Hezbollah. I mean, they cannot rise up against themselves. What I hope might happen is that more and more might become convinced that the solution to this conflict is not armed conflict, but is negotiations and dialogue. And I'm hoping that this will happen on all sides, you know, also on the Israeli side, on the U.S. side, on the Lebanese government side, because that's the only way. You cannot deal with a grassroots popular movement like Hezbollah except through negotiations. And so long as they are viewed simply as terrorist group, then that we will not talk to. It's just impossible to get over any kind of conflict with a group like that. My impression is that the UN resolution reflects a coming to terms with that reality.
We have a caller to bring into the conversation. Let's do that. Someone who is listening in Urbana. This is line number one. Hello.
Hello. Yes, it seems to me that we get a rather one-sided reportage in this country. Regardless of where the Israeli soldiers were when they were attacked and two of them captured, I understand the Israelis had been constantly crossing the border. Is that true?
Yes, very much so. Yes. I mean, if you look at the numbers recorded by the UN, you know, I think, you know, since the establishment of the Blue Line in 2000, Israel crossed it 1,100 times or something, and Hezbollah 150. That's the sort of ratio we're talking about.
Neither should happen, but it is a disproportionate ratio, isn't it?
Yes.
Thank you very much.
All right. Well, again, other questions, comments are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. It seemed to be the case that, as far as Hezbollah was concerned, that part of what this was about, in fact, maybe all of what it was about, was consolidating its position within Lebanon and within the politics of Lebanon. Now, there were a couple of Hezbollah people who were actually part of the Lebanese government in a formal sense. And I think now there seems to be speculation about, well, just exactly now, will Hezbollah have a greater voice in an institutional kind of sense within the politics of Lebanon, particularly Sheikh Nasrallah, who the head of Hezbollah, whether, you know, this man now is in a much more powerful position, maybe in a de facto sense now in Lebanese politics than he was before. Do you think that is the, you know, people there in a lot of the analysis there's all this talk about state within a state and all that sort of stuff. How do you think about that? How do you sort that out?
I very much agree with that. I think that Hezbollah and Sheikh Hassan Nasrallah have reached a level of popularity like they never had before, and they will continue. Their popularity will continue to rise. That, for anyone who is seeking peace, is very dangerous and very, very sad in many ways. A very negative outcome of this conflict, because any sort of radical political ideology is not something that you wish for in your country, because it will certainly not help the country move towards stability. And yes, unfortunately, the Hezbollah are now perceived not only in Lebanon but regionally as having been the only military power that has ever stood up to the Israeli army for more than a few days, and even have, you know, it's perceived that the Israeli forces have failed in their original goal, which was to get rid of Hezbollah, and gradually they began speaking about weakening Hezbollah. But in reality, the military achievement is totally irrelevant next to the moral and real perceived rise in power and popularity of the group throughout the region. That is the sad reality of this post-conflict situation.
Let's talk with some other people who are listening, and we'll talk next with someone in Urbana. This is line number two.
Yes.
Hello.
Am I?
Yes.
I have two questions, quick questions. One is, why did Hezbollah start this? Why did they shoot rockets into northern Israel and capture those soldiers? I mean, it was a very provocative act. And what is your own opinion? My second question is, what is your own opinion of the stated aim of Hezbollah and Iran to eliminate the state of Israel? What's your view of it?
Yes. Well, the first question about the provocative act, or I'm going to say so-called provocative act, because I think that it has, you know, it's primarily the media and the political rhetoric that have transformed that act into a highly provocative act. You know, for one second, and I'm not justifying what they did, but for one second, let's just look at it objectively and see that actually Hezbollah did not launch rockets. What they did is they kidnapped two Israeli soldiers and in the process killed another six on the other side of the blue line. As mentioned before, getting over the blue line on both sides has been regular, something regular, so there was nothing abnormal about that. And then, is, in fact, Hezbollah, what they did is they chose a military target. What would have been a very provocative act would have been if they had actually, you know, attacked civilians. But what they did as a first step was they kidnapped two soldiers, which is in some ways can be perceived as a legitimate military target. And they immediately stated their purpose, that it is in order to get Lebanese prisoners released from Israeli prisons. Now, it's only provocative if you look at it from one side. But if you think, on the other hand, that the Israeli armed forces have been kidnapping thousands and tens of thousands of, well, or let me say, there is over 10,000 Palestinian, Arab, Lebanese prisoner in Israeli prisons that have gone through no process of justice. I mean, these are just totally ignored. We never think about them. Only when Hezbollah kidnaps two soldiers, it becomes an incredibly provocative act. Now, and again, I'm not justifying that because I think it was an act of war more than an act of terrorism. It was an act of war which was inadmissible since they are part of the Lebanese government. But I don't think it was particularly provocative. It's only provocative if you think, okay, who is this little, you know, little guy that you know, pricked the giant? But
can I respond to that, or would you prefer to answer the second question first?
Let me deal with the second question, and then
please.
The second question about the vow, statement that, you know, the vow of eliminating Israel or opposing the Israel's right to exist. I think this is, to a large extent, has become today a lot of political rhetoric. I think there is a time in the early days of the Arab-Israeli conflict in the 40s and 50s and 60s where, you know, the argument that we are going to drive Israel into the sea was actually a serious argument. Right now, I think it's primarily a rhetorical argument just to move people. I think that most Arab governments and sides would be actually at a stage of negotiation with Israel and with recognizing or acknowledging their right to exist. Except, of course, there are always extremists on either side, and there are many many extremists on the Israeli side that also would like to totally get rid of every Arab element in Jewish society. But so I think today it's primarily a rhetorical argument. There are always those extremes that are serious about it, but if only we could go back to negotiations, then
may I respond?
I would overcome that. Yeah,
yeah, go ahead.
When Hitler said he wanted to eliminate the Jews, there were people who didn't take that seriously and said it was just rhetoric. That's one point. The second point, the prisoners in Israeli jails are there because they, basically because they engaged in terrorist acts. And I don't agree with your statement that Israelis were making incursions into Lebanon. In 2000, they withdrew from Lebanon. They have no problem with Lebanon. There's no conflict with Lebanon. I don't think the Lebanese have a conflict with Israel. I think Hezbollah has a conflict. And how you make a distinction between what you call an act of war and I call a provocative act, that really escapes me. I mean, it seems to me that I still don't understand why Hezbollah initiated this. If they wanted an exchange of prisoners, then, as you say, why didn't they engage in dialogue? So that's all. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Well, Dr. Kadd, you can, if you want to make further comment on that, you can.
Yeah, I just want to comment that the reality is that Hezbollah and the Lebanese government had been in in negotiations, not direct negotiations, but had been in indirect negotiations about the release of prisoners in Israeli jails for several years since 2000, and that never happened. In the past, Israel has no precedent of releasing Arab prisoners except through such means. So they're setting a precedent which then is taken up again. And about, you know, incursions, well, I mean, it's sufficient to look at some documents of the United Nations to realize that Israel has actually done 10 times more incursions through Israeli jet planes, spying flights over Lebanon and all other such means into Lebanon since 2000. So even if they withdrew their armed forces from the ground, they were still doing daily incursions into Lebanon. These are facts. They're not invented. I think that's I've said enough about the other points.
We're a bit past the midpoint here. Let me again introduce our guest for this hour, Focus 580. We're speaking with Dr. Martin Akkad. He is the academic dean at the Arab Baptist Theological Seminary in Beirut. It was established in 1960. He is a Lebanese by birth. He has PhD from Oxford and has done a lot of writing on his doctoral dissertation was on the history of the interaction between Christians and Muslims, and is currently working on a book on Christian-Muslim dialogue. He was here visiting in Champaign-Urbana in March, and he was here on the program, and we talked about that. And we thought it would be interesting to talk with him and just get some of his reflections as someone who has very strong personal connections to what has been going on over the last month or so in the fighting between Israel and Hezbollah. He was here visiting in the United States. He was at the Fuller Theological Seminary in Pasadena when the fighting started and could not go back when he had expected to. Now he's in Montreal and has been spending some time in Canada and hopes soon to be able to go back to the United States. He has been the dean of the seminary there since the fall of 2001. He's also the founder and director of the Institute of Middle East Studies there at the Arab Baptist Theological Seminary in Beirut. Questions, comments are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. It seems to me that in a lot of the discussion about what happened, there's been a lot of there have been efforts by people all along the spectrum to determine who did what when, as if to say that somebody started it. It was the other side that started it. And it seems that I guess I would like to see as much influence put on the question of who started it as how it is this seemed to spiral out of anybody's control, and how, in fact, I'm not really sure that for either side that this is what they had in mind when they started out.
Yeah.
And certainly it seems that on the side of Israel now, while the fighting was going on, people were publicly supportive of the government and their troops. And now our people are asking questions about, well, what happened and why? What was the intent? I think there are some people who are even raising the question of whether or not this could bring down the government of Israel.
Mm-hmm.
So it seems that on both sides there are questions about what exactly did they have in mind when they started, and was this what they thought was going to happen?
Yes, that's actually an excellent point. I think. On both sides, on the Israeli and on the Hezbollah side, it is clear that that this conflict was premeditated. There's evidence that has begun to come out from the third week of the conflict that Israel had been planning a three-week war against Hezbollah with the intent of eliminating Hezbollah for at least a year, and some say probably already from 2000, from the time they withdrew from South Lebanon. So I think they were just waiting for the opportunity to do it. The recent scandals about some of the military leadership that had sold all their shares, gotten rid of all their shares just before the conflict started. I mean, and which is right now a scandal in Israel. I think that clearly shows that there was, in any case, a an intention of at some point launching into a major war against Hezbollah on the part of Israel. On the other hand, in Lebanon, Lebanon had been going through what had been called a national dialogue with all the different representatives of the parties sitting around a round table talking about the various issues that are crucial to Lebanon's post-Syria era, if we can put it that way, for several months. And in the last few weeks, these leaders had begun to talk about the issue of the weapons of Hezbollah. Around that table was Hassan Nasrallah, was Hariri, was General Michel Aoun, Samir Jaja, so all the major leaders of Lebanon. And Hezbollah had been very resistant to disarmament. And in retrospect, one can understand why. And I think very clearly also they had been waiting for the occasion to display their military strength. And they did so. So in some ways, I think that both underestimated the reaction of the other, but both had a premeditated plan to display their force. On the ground, Hezbollah did provoke that by kidnapping the two soldiers, but the reaction of Israel was totally disproportionate. And in the end of the day, it's the population on either side that has suffered enormous loss in terms of human life, more than 1,000 deaths in Lebanon, more than 3,000 or 4,000 wounded, over 1 million displaced, I think over 15,000 housing units demolished. I mean, it's disastrous. The infrastructure of the country that had been rebuilt over the last 15 years since the end of the war was totally destroyed in the course of the first 5 days of the conflict. It's just a disaster on every level.
Let's talk with some other people who are listening here. We'll go to Champagne next, line one. Hello.
Thank you so much for giving us this opportunity to discuss these things without the overall major media. One thing I wanted to point out is when a military group on one side gets a military person from the other side, we don't usually call it kidnapping. It's usually called capturing. And I think we've misused that word in order to make Hezbollah sound more like a child molester or something like that. But the one thing I did want to point out, and I don't think I've heard this discussed anyplace else, but you alluded to it, is that the people within the different factions inside Lebanon had been getting together to sit and talk about how they can come together in some sort of a peaceful reconciliation or a recognition of each other as fully competent human beings who have, maybe they have an agenda, but their agenda is legitimate.
Yes.
And we always hear the term, or I've always heard this all of my life, is that Israel is the only democracy in the Middle East. Mm. Now, Lebanon is an example of a democratic coming together to deal with all of the different groups within the country. And maybe that had a, you know, to me it just seems like, well, is Israel objecting to this because they do not treat their Arab population, even living within the country, with the same kind of deference? And if you could comment on that, I would appreciate hearing your thoughts. Thank you.
Yes. Well, I thank you very much for pointing all these things. I very much agree with you on everything you've said. I think the major problem is the way that we represent the other. We just caricature an enemy in order to be able to destroy that enemy better, more effectively, with more support from our people and from the international community. But in the end of the day, the only solution to a conflict is to is to restore a human face to the so-called enemy and begin looking at them differently from as a subhuman category. Lebanon certainly has quite a unique democratic system. It's been suppressed regularly. Our media, you know, we have media figures that have been assassinated. We have politicians that have been assassinated for expressing their opinions. But that in itself is a perfect reflection of democracy. Democracy which costs, which is very costly at times. Unfortunately, democracy in around the world has been more and more just the silent approval of everything that our politicians are feeding us with, and just silencing any kind of alternative opinion. Okay, you can express anything you want in the media, but what impact does it really have in politics? And yes, I think that this whole issue of sitting down at the negotiation table, at the national dialogue, I'm sure not much has been said about it around the world, because, you know, there were no deaths happening, you know, there was nothing dramatic happening. Within Lebanon, on the other hand, it was pretty dramatic. The tragedy of our present government is that it is a weak government. It's a post-Syrian era government that has tried to find a balance and invite opposing parties into government. The result is a government that is unable to take any decisions. So that is tragic, and I don't know if in the present situation of our government we will be able to achieve anything major in the points that are crucial today. But thank you for pointing these various things out.
We have about 7-8 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Again, very quickly, let me introduce again the guest, Dr. Martin Akkad. He's the academic dean at the Arab Baptist Theological Seminary in Beirut. He also founded and directs the Institute of Middle East Studies there at the seminary. At the moment, he's in Canada. Earlier this summer, he was in the United States at the Fuller Theological Seminary in Pasadena when the fighting started and was not able to go home as he had planned. Soon, he hopes to be able to go back. We thought it'd be interesting to hear his perspective as a Lebanese on this conflict. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455, the numbers. Champagne is, Urbana is next, line number two. Hello.
Hello. Don't these suicide bombers realize that if they took a few hours a day and built homes, roads, schools, hospitals, they could build up their society? That'd be 1,000 hours in 3 hours a day, and come and do that year after year instead of make a very positive contribution to their society rather than a one-time destructive event. Over. Thank you.
Well, you have thought about that?
Well, I think it's an opinion that overlooks the whole history of the conflict and of the region. It overlooks the whole questions about what motivates terrorist acts, and it's not a question of justifying terrorist acts. Terrorist acts can never be justified, but they can at least the motivations can be understood. And the reality is, I don't know if I would recommend a film that has recently been done, Paradise Now, which actually, in a very balanced way, studies the psychology that the whole events that can lead someone to suicide bombing. We just think that, you know, it's parents that brainwash their children. That is a very erroneous perspective. The reality is when a people feels trapped in a prison and are oppressed year after year, generation after generation, the sort of psychological state that is produced in a person's mind can lead them to acts of despair. It's difficult for most of us to understand, but we need to listen to that much more human voice of what leads people to this, to acts of despair.
Let's talk again with a caller, Terre Haute, next, line number four, toll-free line. Hello.
Yeah, hi. I have a few observations or comments or perhaps questions for your guest, but the first one is actually for you. It caught my attention at the beginning of your program where you mentioned that his seminary ordained students from a list of different countries. And one country you mentioned I didn't recognize, I couldn't find it on my map, that was Palestine. That's just a comment. There is no such country. There never was. And you mentioned that we had students from that country. That was just an aside. But regarding the doctor's mentioning a few minutes ago about the democracy in Lebanon and the strength of that democracy, and there was a caller who also mentioned that, I might remind you and point out that no other democracy has an active militia that is condoned by the country. Imagine if we had a militia in this country, or we have the slight inkling of a militia, we take action against it and don't allow it. And I was curious to know how he connects the strong democracy and weak government along with the militias, particularly because by the UN agreement of 2000, they're not supposed to be there, and they were supposed to be dismantled.
With regard to the first point about Palestine, well, the reality is that there's a large population of Palestinians in present-day West Bank and Gaza that do not have any citizenship. They are not Israelis. They are Palestinians. There's no other name for them. So,
well, are you talking about Palestinian Arabs, Christians, Muslims, or Jews? There are lots of people in the country that you, I think you're describing. Which community are we talking about here?
We're talking about, regardless of the religious background, we're talking about a nationality of a Palestinian people that are living without any citizenship apart from a Palestinian identity.
When they travel, what passport do they use? I'm confused.
They use, you know, special papers delivered by the Palestinian authorities.
They travel with papers by the... Well, you've still managed to confuse me, and I can clarify it. But
These are the realities. They don't have any other passport or traveling document than special papers delivered by the Palestinian authorities in Gaza and the West Bank.
Let's just call them Israelis or call them Jordanians if you have if you're a history buff.
No, you do not realize the situations on the ground. There's a whole group of people that do not have either Israeli or Jordanian citizenship that are Palestinians. They're living in Gaza and the West Bank.
We'll call them people without country. But people call them people without a country, displaced persons. My parents were displaced persons for several years after World War II. That didn't become Palestinian. It's not a catch-all phrase for people who are displaced persons.
And
be that as it may, let's go on to the militias that are actively involved in the middle of this democracy.
Yes, your statements ignore the history of Hezbollah. Hezbollah was emerged in 1982 as a reaction to the Israeli invasion of Lebanon when they went all the way down to Beirut and set up so-called security zone to protect themselves from, at the time, Palestinian Fatah incursions from the north that were using South Lebanon as their launching pad, and they occupied about 20 to 25% of South Lebanon from 1982 till 2000. In 1982,
let
me just give you the background.
And the agreement was that they were to be dismantled. Let's start from there.
No, let's start from the background, because we cannot ignore the history. The reality is that group became perceived as a resistance group from within Lebanon, not as a militia.
Are they legal?
Sorry?
Are they legal?
Of course, during a war situation and the situation of an occupation, a movement.
When Israel left 2000, the UN agreed that the Hezbollah would be dismantled. From the year 2000, are they legal or are they to be dismantled by international UN law?
Far before the UN resolution, the agreement that ended the war in Lebanon also called for the dismantlement of all the militias in Lebanon. All of the militias were dismantled except for Hezbollah, and that was in the early 90s because Israel was still occupying Lebanese land. When Israel pulled out in 2000, they remained in an area called the Sheba Farms in South Lebanon that has been used as the reason for Hezbollah's continuing existence. You might even say as an excuse for Hezbollah's continuing existence.
Yes, and that was addressed by the UN. And
never resolved, and always just kept ignoring it, never finding a final resolution to it, because every party involved Middle East conflict wants to see the conflict go on because it suits them.
That is simply not true. The UN did address that. International law addressed the Sheba Farms as part of Israel.
Never finally resolved, and the proof is that right now it's again on the table of discussion with the United Nations and Lebanon and Syria.
Pardon me, Dr. Agata, and I also wanted to ask the caller to pardon me for jumping in, but I'm simply going to have to because we're at the end of our time, and I have some other people I cannot take either.
Yeah.
My apologies. I can only say to people who are listening, and I'm sure this is not the last program we'll be doing on this subject, and I'm sure that we will hear from people who would like us to include other points of view, and we'll do that as well, make every effort to do that. For the moment, however, we're going to have to stop. Our guest, Dr. Martin Akkad, is Academic Dean at the Arab Baptist Theological Seminary in Beirut. He is also Director of the Institute of Middle East Studies there at the seminary. He's has written a lot on Christian-Muslim dialogue, is working on a book on that subject right at the moment. He is in Canada, but is hoping soon to be able to go home. Dr. Akkad, thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you. Thank you very much for hosting me.